Like yesterday afternoon when it was raining and the Middle East just seemed so far away, the whole topic seemed kind of an abstraction. But it is very real and alive. And only, I think, if it's disappearing from our radar screens, from the media, it's only an indication of a fault in our information systems. Because I think it's fair to say that the peace process has got a long, long way to go before there's anything like peace going to happen in that part of the world. And yet we're basically, you hear people say, Arabs and Israelis are talking to each other, and that is wonderful, but it's such a small step compared to what is needed for there really to be a lasting peace. And I think that's why our concern as Christians, perhaps, if we're interested in the world, must be to ask, wait a minute, is that story over? Or how much more has to happen there? A group like this, I think, may not be probably laboring, I think, under some of the wider prejudice that exists with the Middle East. But I think we have to keep in mind the images we have of the region and the strength of those images in people's minds. What did they do when the Oklahoma City bomb went off? They stopped some hapless Jordanian in London Heathrow Airport and held him, thinking that he had to be the guy, you know? I mean, this image of terrorism, when you ask groups and congregations, what comes to mind? You say the word Middle East, what comes to mind? And it's sort of a benchmark we have to put behind us. We have to deprogram ourselves, I think. Realize that if we perhaps don't suffer from it, most people do suffer from an amazing amount of prejudice. And I used to say when I was in the region that I think the prejudice against Muslims and Arabs is more complex and more pervasive than I think the prejudice against blacks or against Asians. I think it's more troublesome for us as Europeans, as Christians, as Westerners. It's a more complex prejudice than any other prejudice we have in our world that we and under which we labor. The list people come up with, what comes to your mind, Middle East, they say Arabs, conflict, Muslims, terrorism, sand, oil, these kind of quick images. And an episode like the Gulf War, when I was here at Holden 3 years ago, we were fairly fresh from the Gulf War. It was over a year in the past, but it was tremendously still on people's minds that this is an area, an episode in which we had been, a number had been done on us as a people, playing on those prejudices and allowing more injustice to be added to the already ample injustice under which the region suffers. And I think it was because we were able to play to those prejudices. I love the history behind the term Middle East. It's an American naval historian's term in 1902, which were picked up by the British and started to use by them as it suited their policy in trying to keep open their line to India and secure their control of British India. And then coming back and into common parlance as the term. And what you can ask is, east of what? Luckily the word middle's in there, because if you look at it very briefly in terms of history, I think it's important to keep in mind that if any place on the planet has the claim to being the center of humanity, the Middle East does. I mean, I say that with full deference to the Chinese and the ancientness of their civilization and any place else you might be able to find. But if you consider the confluence of Europe, Asia, and Africa, and all that's gone on in that area, in every sphere of human endeavor and history, the three monotheistic religions that come out of there, the cradle of civilization, the invention of cities, the invention of agriculture, domestication of animals, almost all of the basic indices of what we would call civilization, of the human story, have their roots in that part of the world. And I always remember a history prof at Augsburg College in Minneapolis who used to say to us that if you came to the earth in the 8th century and you wanted to go to the center of things, where would you go? You'd go to Baghdad. As the Islamic civilization flowered, they for 300 or 400 years had a lease on life that made us really look like barbarians, as you were saying a little bit yesterday with the Crusades. And this our prejudice, our one-liners, our, you know, sense for, if you, last time, 3 years ago, this is sort of the theme of the session, of the series that I did, and I showed these clips from Hollywood and from the network news, where some young Arab American filmmakers had taken an hour's worth of stuff out of the network news. And it's just mind-boggling, the ease with which we write off Arabs and Muslims and the region. In our common parlance and our common media language, and why I say it partly is because when you go there and live there, you realize that there's this enormous sense of the past and of their place on earth and of their, what they have to offer to humanity, how great they have been. It's a pitfall for them as well as a strength. But it's so totally different and so much more encompassing than the quick prejudicial dismissal that we have for those people and those region and that region. I won't say more than that, but I think that's real important for us to keep in mind. And just to bring it a little closer to home to us, again, in terms of where we're headed, because I want to focus on the question of threats to this tree, which come down to this one word, emigration. To get there, though, I think we can go beyond speaking of general prejudice, which covers a multitude of sins, but more specifically some sins in relation to the Middle East. And the one that I think we need to jump on as concerned church members is to look out for the travel industry, the sort of biblical tourism industry, which is a wonderful money spinner for Israel and for the travel industry in this country and overseas, for the airlines, and the way in which we unwittingly and very well-intentionedly as Christians play along with that, because we move then from maybe this unexplained prejudice to taking part in one of the key interactions between West and Middle East, which is to go there and to be part of the structure that exists, which in the case of the focus of the Middle East for us, in the case of the Holy Land, is very much in the hand of the modern state of Israel and their travel industry, their transportation industry, their political industry, which sells us a story that we love, a story of pioneers against the desert, a story of success, a story of nostalgic shrines, a story of really essentially Westerners going and taming this wild part of the world. And many, many groups go and partake of this biblical nostalgia, as well as this political hype that serves one side, serves the narrow interest of one of the peoples of the region, and unwittingly add to the imbalance that is so crucial there for perpetuating the injustices that go on. Israel, I have to say, you know, needs a reality check. It needs to know its limits. The leadership needs to know what the people of Israel sense at the present time, that there are limits to what they can get away with. And the question is, do they still need that in this atmosphere of negotiation? And I think the more we come uncritically there as almost accomplices, people who let them show us our holy sites, when there are Palestinian Christians who are living right beside the tombs and the shrines that we visit, whom we never visit. Their figures are totally astounding. There's 2 or 3 or 4 million people who come to Israel every year, most of them Christians from the West. And part of our job with the Middle East Council of Churches over there as the ELCA is to support something called the Ecumenical Travel Office, which is based in Jerusalem. And in its best year, in 1990, at the height of the Intifada, when interest was hottest, when this kind of a topic was very much on our minds, they were only able to handle 1,000 people in a year. So an effort by a church group to say, don't just come here and do what the travel industry would like you to do and not have any of your assumptions challenged. Come here and meet the living stones. Don't meet the dead stones. Don't just concentrate on the past and the nostalgia and, gee, did Jesus walk on this stone or not, you know. But look at the follower of Jesus who may have just sold you a hat keep the sun off your back, but you didn't realize that was a Christian Arab that you were talking to. That imbalance could only be, by concerted effort at a time when the news was hot, could only be a little tiny chink in the armor of the establishment, which goes on and on. And I think if we look at whose interests are served by our typical interaction, because for most of us, we have this sort of very prejudiced view of the region, often reinforced by the media. I live in New York City, and when there's a bombing, you can almost put money on it that the next morning there'll be a Jewish settler or a Jewish mother who has lost her son, or a case of genuine human suffering, front and center on the front page. If it's the other way around, if a Palestinian is killed, or if the Lebanese villages are bombed by the Israeli Air Force, or if some other thing, shenanigan, is going on in the region which has every bit as much human baggage and pathos involved, it doesn't feature. We have this thing going on and on and on. So if we step out of that, we're likely to step out of it to be tourists in the region, and we're tourists in the region as unwitting accomplices of the powers that be that have managed to twist the equation there in a way which is not tenable. We don't have time to talk a lot about the history of the present political arrangements in the region, but the wonderful book by a guy named Fromkin, Peter Fromkin, called The Peace to End All Peace, and he refers to the Middle East peace settlements that were worked out after World War I, as the Ottoman Empire was dismembered and carved up between the British and the French with some American involvement. And as the Balfour Declaration gained currency, the declaration on which the State of Israel was formed, where Britain said it would work to find a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. That man's thesis is that that's a peace settlement on which the jury is still out. And we're now 1995. And if you look at the lines that were drawn in the sand to make the state of Iraq, to make the state of Kuwait, you know, totally arbitrary divisions of by British and French junior officers, really, in the area, it's a very persuasive argument, and it puts the present troubles into a much larger focus in a way that our news never has time to do. You know, that one of the crimes, my work is in media, and one of the crimes of the news, of course, is that it can only deal with the briefest episodic problems. It can't talk to us about the long-term history. And we were talking this morning about the importance of history. It comes up so many times to help us, I think, in our Christian walk in life, to try to be a little bit more on the side of justice and not on the side of injustice. So to leave the tourism question just there in your minds, remembering who is served by it and who isn't served by it. The Israelis are served by it. The American foreign aid establishment is served by it, because we have a lot of money we try to give to Israel every year very, very successfully. It's been as much as half of the foreign aid budget, and it's still there unscathed at 40% with what Egypt gets in this time of slashing of foreign aid for the poor, the real poor countries of the world. Israel is still keeping its part of our foreign aid budget. I talk about that down here. When Israel has a GNP per capita as high as some members of the European community, it's as rich as Portugal and Greece, and yet we aid it to the tune of $1,000 per person per year in our skimpy foreign aid budget. It serves that whole politic of thinking that Israel is our only hope in the region, when people go over there and buy the line that they are fed by one side in this conflict, which is by no means settled. It also, I think, serves our own lifestyle to interact with the region on these very narrow terms. It's easy for us to see it as a place of incomprehensible ethnic and religious groups, of sand, of weird ways of life, and of oil that we need so much. And I thought it was interesting last night on the little panel where somebody was maintaining, I think Michael Muller, that Americans need wars with whether good guys and bad guys. And he jumped from World War II, I think, to the Gulf War, But in between, we had Vietnam, where we gained more of a European understanding of war, I think, as he was alleging, and I think there's some truth to it, where we really, in the movies that have been made about Vietnam, really show us, I think, what has always been true. If you speak to veterans of World War II, the larger purpose was there. I don't know if some of you can speak from experience, but the larger purpose was there, but on the ground, the man in the trenches, the man fighting in that war, or World War I, or any war, has to say what lunacy it really is at a human level. And we sort of partook of that truth for Vietnam, and look what it did to us. We're still trying to exorcise the ghost, because it dogs us as a people who think we know what's right and that we're on the side of right. What did we do for the Gulf War? Put enormous clamps on the press, did an enormous hype job on a conflict and a problem which you could see in many, many other ways, turned it into a good versus bad war, and carried it out in a way that, what did it really do for peace? I mean, at this point, 4 years down the pipe, it really has to be asked, have we solved anything there? Are we going to keep flying over northern Iraq for the next 100 years to try to keep Saddam Hussein or his successors in Baghdad? I mean, not too much was solved. But it's part, I think, of this interaction with the region, which is based on very, very narrow interests, which we as Christians, I think, have to challenge from the start. Finally, just one mention of it, the whole phenomenon of fundamentalism, I think, both on our side and on the Muslim side, in the East and in the West, the chance for fundamentalists to be successful is something that depends on the rest of us and whether or not we have a wide-ranging debate, an honest debate, an open debate, or whether we let these half-truths dominate our discussion and our relationship with the region. When we interact on this level, whose interests are served, we've mentioned a little bit, but whose interests are not served, the missing people, the Arabs in general, Muslims in general, in the case of Israel and Palestine, the Palestinians as a part of the Arabic speaking people of the world, and within them, the people that we have the closest link to, who are a very important connection between us and the region, the Christians of the area, and many, many tourists. Somebody who has broken out of has the chance to break out of the general prejudice and to learn something about the region, never meets a Christian that they may be rubbing shoulders with as they travel through Israel. They may never. It used to be that Palestinians could be your guide in pre-Likud Israel, in the 70s and in the 60s. Chances are you get a Palestinian Christian guide, and so you began to learn, hey, gee, this guy's a Palestinian, he's a Christian. The man explaining where Jesus lived is actually from here. It doesn't happen very often anymore. It's one of the casualties of the occupation. This would be one, if you're ever on one of these tours, if your pastor ever takes a group, you know, he gets a free ticket if he signs up 10 people. You got to insist that they meet the Palestinian Christians at least, if not the Muslims, that they make contact with some of the Christian groups who are there, who are trying to help raise the voice of the Palestinians. Very concrete way, I think, for us to stand against the current, which is so successful. And it's just incredibly galling when you live there to see the success of the Israeli tourist industry on these points. The point that you come to when you have contact with the people that are most comprehensible to us on the other side, if you step out of the American-Israeli coalition and mindset and media, the point that you come to when you meet Palestinians, and then when you meet Palestinian Christians, is this whole question of emigration. Why is this Christian family tree at risk? Why might we say that the parts, and some of these, like the Oriental Orthodox, are scattered around the world. They'll survive in Australia, in Canada, in other places. But will they survive where they were planted? And as I said yesterday, there are plenty of instances that where you sense the vitality of this ancient tradition in the soil of the Holy Lands. But will they survive for too much longer? Because the impact is quite dramatic, in especially this place called Palestine. And I've got a book that I want to mention to you. I didn't ask for it to be in the bookstore here, so I hadn't read it at the time. But it's especially appropriate for us because it's written by a Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem. His name is Mitri Raheb, and he describes his own background, his Greek Orthodox background and Roman Catholic connections, but he's a Lutheran today, and he's the pastor of the Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. And he has studied theology in Germany, and he speaks English with a German accent. And this book is actually written in German and translated into English by someone there who Mitri knows. Interestingly enough, too, he has a sister named Violet who's done all the same study he has, but cannot be ordained because of the church, the Lutheran church there on the West Bank, not coming to the point yet where they can ordain women. But he spends some time on this question of emigration as a threat, one of the main threats, as a consequence of the way in which East and West interact. And I just want to mention a few of his comments on immigration. Why is it happening? And I think it's helpful to think of it as push. People are pushed to leave, and they're also pulled out. And if you have the chance to make the human contact, which sheds light on some of these questions, you come to appreciate how this works. He runs through many factors, saying, first of all, you know, the world is full of people who are emigrating, and human history is full of emigration, so that's not so special, not so interesting. But then he talks about the social factors. For example, that Christians in the Middle East tend to be middle class, and that they have been in places where the contact with the outside has been greater, living in cities, living in towns. I'll just mention them briefly. They've had contact with the West longer than perhaps other people in their society, the perhaps 90-95% Muslim, more contact from the Christians with the West. The orientation towards the West because of the linkage of some Christian groups to Christian missionaries. I said yesterday that most Christian missionaries in the region who came in here in the last century did not convert Muslims, they converted lapsed Orthodox. And then you have the growing circles of contact between a population in the Middle East and missionaries from the West, and some migrate and more migrate. And if you go to a place like Detroit, you have an enormous concentration of Christian Arabs and of Muslim Arabs, where this snowballing feature can be clearly seen, where if you have uncles and aunts over there, then you bring over another uncle and aunt. And you'll see this very clearly in this video in a minute, how what starts with one person mushrooms. And it's so dramatic because it's a relatively recent phenomenon, and the population curves in the Holy Land are quite dramatic from a place like Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, where there were 40,000 Christians at the time of the partition of Palestine, going down now to nobody is even really willing to say, because if they say, it's another feather in the Israelis' caps for them to know that there are only 5,000 or 8,000 or maybe 10,000 of those 40,000 Christians left in East Jerusalem, around the holy sites, the holiest of sites, being pushed by the conditions under which they live, the lack of economic opportunity, the lack of a chance for education, the social and everyday disruption of an occupation, of curfews, of martial law when it's applied, of the soldiers coming through your village and attracting trouble, of land expropriation. There's a wonderful list of the ways in which the land on the West Bank has been alienated from the people. And it's a list you have to keep in mind today as you hear about the discussions on the peace process, because two-thirds of the West Bank is not in Palestinian hands anyway. Are they going to give some of that back? Are they going to make any concessions on those terms. It hasn't been mentioned, as far as you can tell from the dialogue so far. All these things give Christians great reasons to leave, and they emigrate three times faster than Palestinian Muslims. And if you move over to other countries, I said yesterday the different countries where Christians are from Egypt to Lebanon to Syria to Jordan to Iraq to Palestine. In each case, it's the Christians who have by far the highest emigration rates. And there will come a time where they are no longer any left. At the present time, I think with Palestinians, we're talking about 50 or 60,000, about 2 or 3% of the population now is Christian, where it used to be 10%, those left in the country. Somebody asked yesterday about the figures. In Egypt, those 8 to 10 million Coptic Christians make up about 20% of the population. That's a big enough group to hold its own, probably. But in some of the other areas, they are dwindling, and in some areas they are gone. A very dramatic one is in southern Turkey, where Syrian Orthodox Christians have lived for as long as there is any record. The monks in one monastery there had a list of the wars they had seen, and the Gulf War was their 37th war. But there are about 4 monks left in that monastery, when at one time it had 60. And those Christians, Syrian Orthodox Christians in southeastern Turkey, are squeezed between the Kurdish revolt, which you read about sometimes, in that part of Kurdistan, or the Kurdish area, and the Turkish government effort to control the Kurds. Christians are caught in between. The Kurdish rebels make them choose sides. The government makes them choose sides. All the more reason to leave. And they go to Istanbul, and they go to the West. They've been in camps in transit for a long time. So here again, as we've protected the Kurds to a certain extent, we've overlooked this diaspora of the Syrian Orthodox in southeastern Turkey. And if any of you have the chance, have any of you been to Turkey? There's no more dramatic place to understand. As you visit the Old Testament, New Testament church sites like Ephesus, the one we're studying this morning in the Bible study, and to see what was once Christian and what is no longer Christian, and how it's all tied up in the history of the region, and the struggle between the Greeks and the Turks, and the fact that it's still happening, that places that were once thriving are freshly abandoned, as you see villages that have only been abandoned in the last 10 years or 5 years. You have this sense of the threat to the faith in that part of the world. What I'd like to do, without going through more of Mitri's reasons, he goes into quite some detail. I really recommend the book to you. I can give you the data. But I'd like to introduce one family where these questions come into focus. And it's part of the method behind our work there with the Middle East Council of Churches was to try to replicate what happens when people come to the region. A lot of this prejudice and confusion does drop, not away, but it drops down, and you start to see some things that make some sense and inform your life as a Christian and your sense of what is justice for this part of the world. And maybe it makes us able to challenge a little bit some of the political assumptions that we accept from our leaders about relations to the Middle East. So what we tried to do was to pick a Christian family in each country and say, meet a Christian family and understand their situation and see if you have anything to appreciate or exchange, understand from them and their life. And this family is from a village called Taibe. It's a village on the West Bank. When you come up out of the desert from Jericho, from the Jordan River, the land is just like the Badlands. I mean, absolutely unlivable. And then gradually you come into a place where there's a little tiny bit of vegetation and it builds up into the Judean hills where it becomes actually quite fertile. This village is about as far out as you can get where it's still fertile, and the desert lands start within view, and you can run your flocks out towards the desert, but you can't go too far. This village has the tradition that it is the place where Jesus came to rest after he came out of the desert. That's the local knowledge. Now, they can't prove it, hear it, and when you've lived there, been with them for a while, you begin to say, why not? It makes sense. It speaks, it witnesses to you. Whether it's hard truth or not, it witnesses in a way, in a language, I think, of faith. The man you're going to see is traces his family back there 700 or 800 years in that area. And he is a kind of a sorry figure because he is down and out. And everybody who watches it in America says, why does he smoke so much? And it's amazing in our climate of anti-smoking. That's one of the things that people can't get over. Well, I think it's instructive why he smokes so much, because of the pressure he lives under and the fact that smoking is a very successful habit still and well marketed throughout the world in a way that we don't see it anymore here. Palestinians smoke more than any people in the world. If you work with them, you go nuts with passive smoking. This guy has been in prison 3 times for protesting the occupation. He used to be a blacksmith, but his imprisonment lost in his business. In the 6 days we were with him, he always wore the same clothes every single day. And you'll meet his father in the film. His father wears a 3-piece suit on a Tuesday when we met him by accident, Tuesday morning in this little tiny village. The guy's dressed in a suit. Well, it turns out he worked for the British police, the Palestine police, for the British mandate. And he thinks of himself as sort of a man of the world. And he spends quite a bit of time going to Guatemala to visit his other sons and daughters who all live in Guatemala. Now, you're going to meet the man's sons. One of them is dead, as you'll find out from the Intifada. The second one has a disorder and he's mute. And it's a small operation to correct his problem, but it has never been done, and he's growing up disabled to a certain extent. And then the youngest son, on whom the family name rests. And you'll get a sense, as you hear his story, of this question of being pushed and pulled to emigrate. But Hassan Arantie, the guy, the main person in the film, refuses to go. He refuses to go, and he challenges us with some really good one-liners, and boy, the Palestinians are great for speaking like Hanan Ashrawi with one-liners. He says, you want us to turn to God? We have prayed a lot, but the answer is not up there. Maybe God has left us. He's flown from the skies over Palestine. Maybe he's gone to Europe and America. Maybe he's chasing after money. Almost a Old Testament challenge to God and who he is and what he's up to. And then he says, America and Europe are Christian countries. If you believe in God, then you believe in justice. And that justice applies to us more than any other people. A little bit of pride there. I'm not sure the Palestinians are the hardest done people in the world, but they say they are. And he's quick to link that to us as a challenge for our concern for justice. If you've got questions up to this point, please ask them, or comments. What I'll do is put this on, and it takes about 15 minutes, and let him speak for himself. Can someone switch on the little button in the back, upper surface there, to let it warm up? The interesting thing is, this village of Taibe is the most Christian village of the West Bank. In terms of percentages, it's 95% Christian. You won't see a minaret on the skyline. You'll see three steeples. A Roman Catholic, a Greek Orthodox, and a Greek Catholic. It's also the village from which Sirhan Sirhan came, the man who shot Robert Kennedy. He's a Palestinian. This is his village. I think it's ready. Maybe. Pull the shade down. There's also a monitor up here if you like a little more fidelity in your picture.
My name is Ghassan Ibrahim Jalil Anki. My family has been in this area for 700 or 800 years, as far back as we can trace our roots. This village, Taibe, is located about 20 miles by road north of Jerusalem. It is a Christian village. All the young men in Taibe come to this karate club. It helps improve their social, academic, and athletic standards, no matter who they are. I can say that the West Bank is my country, and Taipei, my village, is like my mother. I had a boy. He was athletic, he was active, and he was smart. There is a certain olive grove in the village, and in the summer of 1988, Israeli settlers in this region came through Taipei and started a big fire in that olive grove. The whole village went down to fight the fire. It took us a long time. Then our young men got together to keep the settlers off our land. They threw stones. And the settlers returned the compliment by opening fire. This turned into a confrontation between us and the Israeli army. The army could have aimed at the legs of my boy, but they hit him in the body. We learned later that they had used dum-dum bullets on him, fragmentation bullets. They shot from down there. He fell here, by the wall. There is the Israeli settlement of Ramonim. The Jews take the high ground, then they encroach on our land little by little, while we are not allowed to build. I myself was building a house on the edge of the village, but the occupation authorities stopped me. Now I use the place as a chicken coop. My present situation is very difficult. From day to day, the chicken farm at least gives me a way to feed my family. There is not much money in chickens, but I suppose it's easy for someone like me to work with them. They don't answer back. They suffer without protest. I have always asked myself why the Palestinian people have to suffer so much, and why we can't live like all other peoples. Aren't we just trying to survive, like everyone else? But it seems that we keep paying the price for the mistakes of others.
My name is Ibrahim Jalil Aranki, born in Taipei 1919, and still living in Taipei. I am retired now, but I have some olive trees and land. First, I was working in the police, Palestine police force. I was officer in charge in Ramallah district for 17 years. I was married, first married, 1941. I have seven 9 children, 7 boys and 2 girls. Hassan, he is one of them. He is living in Ampay. Basil, he is living in Guatemala. Hello, Soto. And this is Hamla. He is living in Sacramento, United States. With his wife.
The difference between me and my brothers is that their life abroad is financially more rewarding. The harder you work, the more you can make of yourself. Here, things are different. If we don't work for a day, we don't eat for 2 days. If I would emigrate, it would be an abdication of my responsibilities as a Palestinian. I have to stick by my people. A lot of them also refuse to leave their land. They would rather suffer than give in to the occupation.
Before 40 years, there was living in Taiwan for 1,000 people. But now, only 1,000 people, because all of them, they're going to United States, South America, and Jordan. There is no factory here in Taiwan. Nobody works. There is only the olive trees in Taipei, but last year there is no rains. We lose everything. If anybody who have no people in America or in the Gulf, they are very poor. No work. Especially my son Hassan. He's lost his son, first son, killed the others. He's not broke.
My father was a policeman under difficult conditions during British rule. They were also an occupying power. He earned his daily bread, but the work was imposed on him. My second son, Samir, had a problem with his ears when he was young. He never got proper treatment, and now he's too old to go to school. But we would like him to have an operation so he could be normal and work with me and get married and be a father. But this operation is beyond us and only available outside the country.
You see now, today there is Jewish soldier. They follow the marches, follow the building. Be income tax. The man, he's not working and he will get nothing. How to pay income tax? We ask America or Europe especially to help us. We hope the peace will come, but if we stay what we are, no, there is no hope. We lose everything. This is our life. No works, nothing to do. You hear, they shouting. They are shouting. Every day, they come and they do it and talk. Somebody here.
They threw some stones at the army, and the army shot back and they missed. Nobody was hurt. They're provoking the people. This is a daily occurrence. We have to counter all these provocations. If the Israelis hit us, we hit them back. Taipei is near a strategic crossroads for the Israeli settlements. They are always passing through our land. and the settlement of Ramonim is built on Taibe village land. They have already expropriated a lot of our land. And every now and then, whenever they expand the settlements, it is at our expense. Don't forget that crops and livestock are our major source of income. We live from this land, and always have. This village is holy in the past and even in the present time. Our Lord Jesus Christ is from the Jerusalem area. He used to go from place to place and after the temptation in the desert between here and Jericho. He came to this village to rest and to be with friends. From here he went on to Bet-El, Anata, and other places. A lot of pilgrims retrace his steps every year. I'm proud of the fact that Jesus Christ passed through Taipei and talked with the people here. To this day, 95% of the village is Christian. Greek Catholic, Roman Catholic, and Greek Orthodox, the largest church. I built these new doors and a lot else when I still had my blacksmith shop. I keep asking myself why the occupation and the occupation authorities keep putting me in prison. They charge me with incitement against the occupation. This is a so-called administrative arrest. So they say they don't have to show any proof. To me, incitement against occupation really means that you love your country. But being in prison twice since my son was shot makes it hard to support the family. In a way, all the years as an occupied people are a bit like killing the person inside the Palestinians. We are a bit dehumanized. We are like a tree that is not allowed to bear fruit. There is so much inner emptiness in Ketziot, the Israeli prison in the Negev desert that is full of Palestinians. To pass the time, we carved souvenirs by hand from stones and toothpaste tubes. I made one in honor of my son, who was martyred. Each one carries a symbol for my children and my wife.
When my husband was in jail, for a year altogether, I was carrying the double responsibilities of mother and father. I had to teach my youngest son and ask how he was doing in school. My second son, who is mute, he gave me a hard time, breaking things, damaging things. I used to put up with it and try to adjust his hearing aid. That's the way it was.
إبراهيم بقدرش من ورا أترسيته ولا بقدر أحصر دماغي ولا من ما قبلتها
بتشي. I can't talk about Ibrahim. I just can't put my thoughts about him together. I peeled all these garlics.
زي وساعة عرنكي بكون الصبح على المدرسة وبرجع بحل فروضي وبتغدى بحل فروضي بروح بلعب شوي بعدين بروح على الكراتيه.
My name is Salim Hassan Aranki and I play football. I go to school, I finish my homework. I go to the karate club and then I come back home.
بنقطع بنيحة وبقطع الجيش منها
Taipei would be nice if the army would leave it, that's all.
After we got out of jail, the Israelis gave us green cards. If you have one of these, the army can interrogate you, beat you, just for leaving your village. That is why I am desperate. You feel like you don't have the right to live. The Palestinian day is the equal of many days in other lands. Each minute under occupation is like hours. We are not the ones who planted thorns, but we are the ones to reap a harvest of thorns. This is our motherland, and we should stay in the bosom of our mother, who holds all her children to her breast without discrimination. We need honest friendships here on this earth. Even if we may talk about divine justice, how long are we supposed to wait for that justice to unfold? The European and American societies are predominantly Christian. But do they truly believe in God? We have begun to doubt this, because if you believe in God, then you believe in justice. And that justice applies to the Palestinian people more than any other people in this world. You want us to turn to God? Oh, we have prayed a lot. But the solution is not up there. I asked my friends their opinion, and they say it seems that our God has left, has traveled from the skies over Palestine, has gone to Europe and America. Maybe he is going after money. And we are a penniless people. That is our justice. Here lies glory. Here lies pride. Here lies dignity. Proclaim, O youth, rejoice, O women, to the martyr of the Intifada, the hero, Ibrahim Ghassan Aranki, born 25-7-1973, martyred 29-6-1988. My son gave his life for this country. It was a bitter experience for me, like losing part of my own self. He is living inside me, and I cannot forget him at all. As our Lord said, do not put your candle under a bushel. Our light must be strong. I have never in my life thought to travel or give up my country. My son is here, and I only think of building a small house. My dreams are for nothing out of this world. With suffering, they will come true.
Since this was filmed in 92, everybody in that family has left the village except Hassan and his wife and his two sons. So it's like we caught a moment in the process. You know, he said there used to be 4,000 people, now there are 1,000 people. The father mentions his sons, where they are, Sacramento, Jordan, Guatemala. Now, the father's in Guatemala. There's another sister in the village still, whom we didn't mention. She's in Guatemala. and the trend continues. Now the question we have is, since there have been some developments since this time, is how much do they amount to? I mean, that's my question as I look at it. The shooting, which just happened during the interview and they ran out and tried to find, that was everyday life in 1992. That if this present agreement, which was agreed last week to get the Israeli troops out of the population centers, but not all of them, I don't know if Taiba is included, that probably wouldn't happen as often anymore. It hasn't been happening since the cooling down of the Intifada. But the troops are still there, the guard posts have been still there, that's what they're trying to get out. You saw the long shot of the settlement on the ridge, and they're always on the ridge above. And this one's far away, some are right next door to villages. Those settlements have not been put on the table at all, as far as I can tell, in the peace negotiations. The roads the settlers used to get there is their own whole network of roads. Those aren't on the table. So as I watch it, I think, how much of this destabilizing and factors, injustice, and linked to the Christians, the push for immigration, how much of that is really being removed by the present process? And I'm not so sure very much is. It's calmer now, but is it calm enough to give people hope? Except this guy, who's obviously a pretty diehard character. But some comments or questions you've got? We've got about 3 minutes, I guess.
There are a few Americans who understand and are concerned about the fate of Palestinians. Is there no way to, the number is few, perhaps you have a sense of that. Mm-hmm. Is there any way for them to harness their, congeal their concerns and
in this country?
In this country, and exercise some yeah. Calm?
Well, it happens. There's something called Churches for Middle East Peace, which is a network of church concern for the Middle East. We're quite active in it through the ELCA, through the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington. There are places like the Augsburg Center for Global Education, which runs trips to places like as well as others. There is a network, but it needs us to be aware of it and to be concerned as well. I think it needs as much support as can be found, especially in this moment now where it's no longer a hot story. You know, we basically think that peace has been declared or is on the way to being declared. And I think that if you talk to Palestinians, they'll say, wait a minute, you know, where is Jerusalem on the table? Where are the settlements? Where is water, the question of water? The West Bank sits on the aquifer that Israel uses for most of its water. Are they going to let the Palestinians actually control any part of that? These issues are still very, very important if we want to think about a lasting peace. One thing that strikes you so much in the Middle East is that the place has been swept by invasions back and forth and occupations. Palestine's been under four or five different hegemonies this century alone. You know, the Israeli, the British, the Turkish, and there's one more. Maybe it's counting Egypt over Gaza, or over part of the thing. But, you know, is this just invasion? There's usually 22 or 25 invasions when you read the guidebooks as you travel around the Middle East. They go back to the Hittites, you know. Are the Israelis just invasion number 23? That's the view taken by most of the Arabs who are right now down and out, you know, around them. They're willing to say, we'll get back. It might take 100 years, it might take 200 years. And I'm enough of a bleeding heart, I guess, that I would like to say, as Christians, we need to aim for something a little higher than that. Whether or not we have an effect, our goal has to be that the basic questions be on the table, and the issue of Jerusalem.